I am extremely excited to be sitting across the desk here from a gentleman who I've respected for many years. His name is Dr. Deepak Chopra. Dr. Chopra has a pretty phenomenal history, and many of you who have been with me throughout the years know how strongly I feel about the power of physiology to shape human emotion, human behavior, and ultimately our destiny. And the choices that we have to make along the way rather than giving the responsibility to somebody else. And I've exposed you to many different people, from Bernie Siegel to Norman Cousins just before he died. So to be with Deepak Chopra, I just want you to know this man, I believe, is one of the living masters in being able to teach people the fundamentals of what reality really is beyond the physical body, what really shapes our lives. So it's really a privilege to be with you, Deepak.
It's a privilege to meet you, Tony. I've admired you for a long time.
Well, thank you. We're here in Lancaster, Massachusetts, and we're at the Ayurvedic Center, Health Center here. And I think maybe what we could do is start out by just giving people a little bit of your background. You have a very traditional medical background, and yet now you're considered by most to be, I think, the foremost expert in the area of understanding mind-body medicine or psychoneuroimmunology. Why don't you give us a little background? Where did the shift happen for you?
The shift happened a while after I had been in practice. I was an academic to start with. I was teaching at Boston University School of Medicine and at Tufts and for a while at Harvard. And that part was so exciting from an intellectual point of view and so challenging that I was very happy doing that. But when I really started going into practice and seeing patients, I found that the academic intellectual challenges, exciting as they were, really had very little to do with how people got well.
Yes.
I was sitting there spending all my day writing prescriptions, and at the end of the day I would feel that I had been a legal drug pusher, because what was I doing? I was writing prescriptions for tranquilizers, sleeping pills, and antibiotics. If I ever told my patients, listen, maybe if you stop smoking or cut down on your alcohol or changed your weight, perhaps we could wean you off some of these drugs. And they'd say, well, you know, doc, my mother-in-law says the same thing. She doesn't charge me $50. How do I do it? And if you look back, you realize that medicine perhaps has all the answers, but it doesn't have the technologies to make people want to change.
Yes.
Or even if they want to change, doesn't have the technologies to show them how to change.
Yes.
It was very frustrating. So it was my unhappiness that led me out from what I was doing.
Pain drove you to something.
Yes, pain.
So what was the evolution of it then for you? Where did you begin to look? You obviously, you were born in India, correct?
Right.
And so was your experience, your exposure to Ayurvedic medicine back then, was that, were you going back to your roots? What triggered you to go there for the answers? Or did you start out there?
No, actually I had a background in India, and some of it was a distorted perception of what Ayurveda was. I used to think of it as some kind of folklore or folk medicine.
Yes.
With a lot of herbology, but nothing more to it. In 1980, I started practicing transcendental meditation. In 1985, I was at a medical conference, and Maharishi was there in Washington. And after the conference, he sort of asked me to come to his room, which I did out of politeness more than anything else, because I wasn't interested in anything that had to do with quote-unquote mysticism.
Yes.
And I found him to be a very practical man. And we talked for a while, and he said to me that I should look, with my background in medicine, I should look into Ayurveda. I was polite enough to say that I would, but I didn't mean to. I left the meeting, and I went to the airport to go home. And at the airport, I met an old friend of mine from medical school, and he handed me a book. He said, this is about Ayurveda. Maybe you find it interesting. So I said, there's some message here.
Yes.
I read the book. It was fascinating. I went back to Maharishi. I said, send me to India. Let me meet all the people who are experts in it. I really want to get into this. And I did.
Wow. Now, at that time, were you the chief of staff at New England?
Yes, I was.
They must have thought you were crazy.
Yes, I was. And initially, the response was, yes, that I was off the wall. My partners didn't know what I was up to. Some of them were even embarrassed about all the things I was engaged in. But I didn't care anymore. I was on a mission, yeah.
Now, what began to make you believe that you really have found some answers here beyond your traditional medical training?
For one thing, I was able to influence people in a way I had never been able to do it. I was able to make them lose weight or stop smoking or give up alcohol, to make them want to be healthy. And then I started seeing some dramatic remissions in illness, in chronic illness. I'd have patients come here, for example, and they'd be taking 15 medicines, about 10 for their problem and 5 for the side effects from the medicines that they were taking. Yeah. And within a week or two, we'd have them off everything, and they didn't have this problem anymore. They'd have bronchial asthma for 15 years, and now they don't have it anymore. Yeah. They've been taking drugs for arthritis for 10, 15 years, and it's not there anymore. And then when we started seeing occasionally a dramatic remission and somebody would say cancer, you start thinking, what's really happening here? Are we really, we've missed out on perhaps a few billion years of learning experience, because the human body, as it turns out, is an exquisite pharmacy. It makes every drug that Hoffmann-La Roche makes and more.
Better quality,
the right dose, the right target organ, no side effects.
Cheaper.
You have access to it, and all the instructions are there in the packaging.
Yeah.
So I said, and it's evolved over billions of years of evolutionary time. All the mistakes, you can make the precise antibody for pneumococcus because some ancestor a few hundred thousand years ago perfected that technique, and you have it inside your body.
In your DNA.
So why not use this huge library of information?
So what prevents us from doing that?
Interference.
Social hypnosis?
Yeah, it's the hypnosis of social conditioning. It's violation of basic, simple laws of nature that make our body function. There are simple processes going on in our body all the time. The simple processes are eating, breathing, digestion, metabolism, elimination, and something that controls all of these, and that's consciousness. Thought, at a very fundamental level, non-verbal, not linguistically structured and verbally elite and speaking in the English language with an Indian accent,
but communication. At a cellular level.
A network of communication, a network of intelligence, communication and information, which is controlling all these processes. You get in touch with these processes, and you eliminate 95% of all disease. You can even reverse most of disease if you get in touch with these basic life processes. That leaves about 5-6% of disease, which is genetic. But even genetic disease is the stress of our ancestors. If we pay attention to what we're doing in our generation, we'll be doing the next generation a lot of good.
Makes sense. You and I both know from our mutual studies and individual studies that the power of belief to change biochemistry, to change instantaneously the way the body responds to anything, it's that sense of certainty. And some people are trying to pursue it through affirmations and pumping themselves up, but rarely does that really give you the sense of certainty. Whatever we're certain about really in our heart of hearts seems to show up in our body. And I think I read once you said that the body is a printout of our consistent thoughts or our consciousness. Tell me, what is the biggest misconception that we have about the human body? What is the metaphor that we're using that's keeping us locked in where we're always at the effect of rather than understanding we're truly the cause of our experience?
The biggest mistake is that we are steeped in the superstition of materialism. The superstition of materialism says that this world is made up of physical objects in space and time. And if there is such a thing as thought or consciousness, then it's the epiphenomenon of matter. In other words, if I have thoughts and feelings and emotions and desires and instincts and drives and likes and dislikes and passions and hatred, if I believe in God or heaven or hell or salvation or damnation or communism or feminism, all these things occur because there's the dance of molecules in my body. That biochemical reactions somehow produce the epiphenomenon that we call thought. That we are physical machines that have learned how to think. Well, in fact, it's probably
reverse,
the other way around.
Yeah.
Not probably, surely the other way around. We are thoughts that have learned how to create the physical machine. We are impulses of intelligence in a larger universe of intelligence. This is a thinking universe. We are impulses of intelligence in a larger void of intelligence that have learned how to create physical matter. We create the mind. We are not the mind. We create the mind. We create the body. And through our body and our mind, we ultimately create the experience of the world. By itself, the world is just quantum soup. It's a radically ambiguous, ceaselessly flowing field of all possibilities. And out of that field of all possibilities, we can create anything we want. We're like King Midas. Only he knew only how to create gold. Everything he touched turned into gold. We can create anything we want.
Greater level of choice.
Much, infinite choice.
Yes. Tell me, what is the body?
If you went to a physicist, a really first-class physicist, and asked her, what's the real...
Asked her, I like that. Very good.
Asked her, what's the real nature of the physical body? She might say, if you could look at it, not through the artifact of sensory experience, then you'd see, which is, you know, the superstition that what I can see and touch and taste and smell is the way things only are. That's wrong. After all, my senses tell me that the earth is flat and nobody believes that anymore. The senses tell us that the ground we're standing on is stationary and we know it's spinning at dizzying speeds.
Or the light we see in the sky at night is still there when it may be gone millions of years ago.
Exactly. Yes. So forget the superstition of materialism and begin to see things as they really are. Well, the physicist would tell you that the body is a dynamic field of energy, information, and intelligence that's constantly renewing itself in every second of its existence. That you, in fact, make a new body once a year. That even this moment, you have a million atoms in your body that were once in the body of Christ, or Buddha, or Genghis Khan, or Leonardo da Vinci, or Saddam Hussein, for that matter. That your physical body is a river of intelligence and information. 98% of all the atoms come and go in less than 1 year. You make a new skin once a month, a new skeleton every 3 months, a new stomach lining every 5 days. Even the brain cells that you think with as carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen, they weren't there 1 year ago. And the DNA, the genetic material, which holds millions of years of information, the actual raw material, the carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, comes and goes like migratory birds every 6 weeks.
So let me ask you a question. Somebody has cancer, and the first thing that the average person does, obviously, is immediately respond with horror, with fear. They immediately are told by their doctor they have so much time to live, or they have so much percentage of chance of living. They now think to themselves, I have this thing in my body I've got to get rid of. What you're saying is that thing in their body they call tumor is not going to be the same tumor a year from now. Is that true?
It's true. If I look at an x-ray and see a tumor and I compare it with the tumor from 6 months ago, am I really looking at the same tumor? The answer is, on the material level, no. Every single atom of carbon, of hydrogen, of oxygen, of nitrogen that makes up this tumor is not the same, is different from the tumor 6 months ago because of the rapid changeover.
Right.
However, because the underlying quantum mechanical framework is the same, in other words, the cellular memory is the same, or the underlying physiological processes at a non-material level are the same, it keeps coming back the same way. It's like if I had the ability to change every brick in this building once a year, but I'm stuck with the notion this is the only way to do it, I'd get the same looking building every
right.
time. If I want to get rid of this tumor, I have to exorcise the ghost of this tumor. And by the ghost of this tumor, I mean the impulses of information, energy, transformation, memory, conditioned response, all the things that structure the non-physical aspects of the tumor that result in this physical expression. It's estimated, for example, that we have 60,000 thoughts a day. That's not surprising. The disconcerting thing is that most people, 95% of the thoughts they have today are the ones they had yesterday. So we become bundles of conditioned reflexes and responses constantly being triggered by people and circumstance into very predictable biochemical outcomes, behavioral outcomes, mm-hmm. and ultimately physical outcomes. So the body turns over 6 billion cells a day. 1% of these are mutations. So everybody's body has cancer cells all the time.
That's right.
But we get rid of them every day.
Amplified. Problem is, though, if we keep putting the same cause in motion, the same thought cause, the same belief cause, the same expectation cause, then we're going to keep getting the same results because we're going to take the material and we're going to translate it accordingly. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly, exactly. The recipe remains the same. You can take the same ingredients, have another recipe, and you'll have something else.
Because we're funneling it in identical ways.
Exactly.
So until we change, I mean, it sounds complex, but what we're really saying is until we change our basic core fundamental beliefs, our sense of certainty about what is and what will be, then whatever we are certain about will be in our lives, as we think so we'll experience.
Exactly. In fact, Tony, what it is it's an interpretation of what's happening to you. If I go out on a joyride on Magic Mountain in Disney World, and my interpretation is at a deep level, somewhere, I believe, as you said, in the deepest part, this is fun. Then my body makes interleukins and interferons. These are powerful anti-cancer drugs.
That's right.
If you had to buy interleukin to treat melanoma or kidney cancer, a full course would cost you something like $40,000 and a lot of side effects. But you could take that joyride and make $1 million worth of interleukin too, if at the core of your being, you were having fun. On the other hand, if your interpretation was this is terror, then you'd make cortisol and adrenaline and all kinds of things which destroy the immune system.
Yes.
The difference between destruction of the immune system and stimulation of the immune system, a difference which could mean the crucial difference between life and death, is an interpretation. I take an experience and I say, this is a very tranquil experience. I'm having the experience of tranquility at a deep level of awareness. My body, my leukocytes, my adrenal cells, my macrophages will start churning out Valium. This Valium, unlike the one that you buy from Hoffman LaRoche, is the real diazepam. It is the molecule of tranquility.
Yes.
And it modifies and modulates the activity of the immune system so that cells can do their job in tranquility. The meaning that you give to an event is the event.
Yes, exactly.
Is the event.
What I call it is the label you put upon experience becomes experience.
Exactly, because there is no such thing as actual reality. There is only the perception of reality.
That's correct.
See, and that perception of it is an interpretation that the self makes to the self.